Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to the very first boat briefing of 2022. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Sophia Wilson, our Acting Deputy Editor. Sophia, Happy New Year.
Thank you very much, and Happy New Year also to all of our wonderful listeners.
Tell us, before we get into some chit-chat, tell us about this week's interviewee.
So this week, Charlotte caught up with explorer Victor Vescovo. Victor owns the explorer vessel, the Challenger Deep, and the Triton sub Limiting Factor. She was very lucky to catch him as he'd literally just returned from diving the deepest point of the Camaldic Trench in the South Pacific Ocean, which has a calculated depth of 10,003 metres. He spoke to her about everything from the amazing tech they have on board the sub, including the world's first 4K camera, which was developed especially for them, and the flexibility that having a manned sub offers, through to discovering new species and their upcoming mission to discover the Midway battle site with all the wrecks from Pearl Harbor, which has areas that no one's ever captured on video before. As we know from the past, he's a fascinating guy, and what they've been doing on their missions is really cutting edge stuff. They've achieved so much despite all the issues that COVID's been throwing up, which he also mentions. So yeah, make sure you stick around that at the end of the podcast once Stuart and I have gone through all this week's news and data.
Yeah, Victor, what a fascinating guy. He has been deeper than anybody else in human history. So Rob McCullum from EOS Expeditions worked with him on the Five Deeps expedition and the Ring of Fire one. And I got Rob to tell me what it was like traveling or descending in Limiting Factor to the bottom, the deepest point of the Pacific Ocean. And mainly for puerile reasons, my main concern was what happens if you've got to go to the toilet, because it takes hours to descend and hours to get back up.
Did you quiz Rob exactly on this?
Yeah, so he does. He's got a technique, which any interested.
We've really lowered the tone very early on in 2022.
But there is a way. There's a way to take the need to use facilities out of your mind. It's very interesting. I got him to explain it to me at the Explore Yacht Summit last year. But yeah, I mean, Victor, what a fascinating individual, and what an effort to do what he's done. Just, you know, a guy who's just set some amazing records. And I know there's a bit of a debate between him and the director, James Cameron, about who's been deeper in the Pacific Ocean, because James Cameron went down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench a few years ago. And Victor and the EOS Expeditions guys think they were deep, because the Pacific Ocean isn't flat, it undulates, and they went to the bottom of an undulation, whereas I think James Cameron, they suspect, was at the top of one of these undulations. So I think they went a few meters deeper. But anyway, I mean, when you're that deep, what does a few meters matter? Just an incredible expedition.
And moving on from incredible expeditions, your festive period was not quite as adventure-filled as you'd hoped, Stuart, is that right?
Well, there was no adventures whatsoever, because my entire family got COVID. So obviously I was struck down. I think my middle daughter brought it into the house, then I got it, then my wife got it, then all the other kids got it. So I did some isolation, then the rest of the family got it. What was the point of isolating anymore? Obviously, we all stayed in our house and didn't go out, which was pretty boring. But I ended up watching way too much Below Deck than was good for my health, and various other streaming TV shows.
Well, it's a bit of a busman's holiday, isn't it, watching Below Deck over the Christmas period?
Well, I never really watched a lot of it before. I mean, I watched the first ever episode a while back, and that was it. That was my exposure to Below Deck. But then it was on my Netflix recommendation, so I just flicked it on at one point, and before I knew it, I was deeply invested in a love triangle between a chef, a deckhand, and a bosun. And the problem is with those streaming shows, you kind of get to the end of one episode, and if the remote control is not within arm's reach, which for some reason it never is for me, the autoplay gets the next episode going before you can get up off the sofa. So it locks you in for another episode, and before you know it, it's 2 a.m. And you're wondering what you're doing with your life. I think that's a real problem, I think. It's like the Emily in Paris thing. Do you watch Emily in Paris?
No, but I have a similar issue with my 18-month-old that when a Cocomelon episode ends, she knows it goes on to the next one, so you
Yeah.
have to react really quickly to get it off.
I think it's very clever. I think the Emily in Paris thing, because the episodes are quite short, and it's kind of like wallpaper TV. You can doom scroll Twitter and have Emily in Paris on at the same time. And whilst it's running, you get to the end of an episode, and you don't really have to pay attention. And then the next one's playing within a few seconds of the previous one finishing. And so again, you're locked in, and basically you've watched the entire series, but really have no idea what was
Is
going
that the excuse you're using for why you've watched the entirety of Emily in Paris
to.
and Below Deck? How many seasons of Below Deck did you get through during isolation?
I watched a med one. I watched two med ones, I think. I don't really know how many series there are or where these ones fit in the running of them. It was just that was just the one that was kind of pushed at me on Netflix.
Well, our online editor, Holly, is our resident Below Deck expert, so I'm sure she'll be able to talk you through exactly which season you've watched and the crucial points of each of them.
Yeah, Captain Sandy was the captain of one of them I watched. She's brilliant, isn't she? Big fan of big new fan of Captain Sandy. So that was my COVID experience. There's lots of TV, well, way too much TV, really. I promised myself I'd be productive and I'd use the time well, but I failed miserably in that endeavor. But it was nice over the Christmas period. We did get some lovely emails about the podcast, which was great. So it's always nice to know people are listening. I mean, we see the numbers. But it's very nice when we get emails from people saying as they tune in every week, which is fantastic. And just on that note, if you do want to get in touch and you want us to interview a particular person or someone from the industry or an owner or anything really, or you want us to look into a particular bit of data around the CPO industry, just drop us a line. So the email address is podcast@boatinternationalmedia.com, and one of the team will be in touch. The other thing, of course, that happened over New Year's, whilst I was watching Emily in Paris and way too much Below Deck, there was the annual congregation of Cypriots in St. Bart's for New Year's Eve. So anyone not familiar with the Cypriot business might not know, but generally St. Bart's is the kind of destination for New Year's Eve. And this year there were more than 90 Cypriots. There's a couple anchored in Gustavia Harbour, obviously, but most were anchored off. There were 93 to be precise, which was 15 more than in that was there for New Year's Eve 2020.
And you're heading out to St. Bart's later this year, though, aren't you? Is that the plan, Stuart?
COVID permitting, yeah. So I'll be flying out there with Toby Moore, our co-CEO, to enjoy the St. Barts bucket and do some sailing, and then after that, heading to the Palm Beach Boat Show, where hopefully we'll get a chance to see lots of people too. Actually, the Boot Dusseldorf, I noticed that over the Christmas period, that's been cancelled for 2022. So that's the big kind of marine trade show happening in Dusseldorf, obviously Germany. I think it's usually late Jan, Feb, isn't it? So that's a massive show, and they took the decision to cancel that.
Yeah, it's a shame. I feel the kind of winter events are really being penalised by COVID.
Yeah. Hopefully, this will be the last winter season of that happening, though. Well, fingers crossed. You never know with this thing, do you? But there was loads of boats. COVID didn't get in the way of a healthy St. Barts season. So there's the usual big boats in town. Eclipse was there, obviously. Le Grand Bleu. Nero Varvar 2 was there. Some newer boats were in town too. Moonrise, the Fed ship. Olivia O and Excellence. The reverse bowed Aberking. Jeff Bezos was on the island celebrating. He was on his Instagram, looking like he was having some fun. And maybe next year he'll be in St. Barts on his own boat. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
I mean, it's definitely that Ocean Cove, whether it is Jeff Bezos's or not, is definitely the kind of most exciting launch to look out for this year, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's kind of the biggest story of 2022 in the Cypriot world.
Do you think some yacht spotters are already kind of camping out by the Ocean Cove sheds, just in their tents already, just in case they sneak it out without them noticing?
I'm sure there'll be an army of drones in the air when that thing Hits the water, absolutely. And we'll hopefully we'll have a drone amongst them to bring you some cool pictures and videos of that very, very exciting boat. We should talk about some. There was some corporate news. So it was announced just before Christmas that Boat International Media had acquired a company called Boating Communications. For those of you in the know, Boating Communications is the parent company of the well-respected B2B title IBI, which has been around since 1968. I didn't know that. 1968. There you go. So it's just a really IBI.
Older than you.
Yeah, a good deal older than me. I'll have to. So I mean, IBI kind of is the B2B, the biggest player in the B2B sector, addressing kind of the volume boat industry. So they touch the superyacht sector, but really their focus is kind of the production market. So it's a nice complement for Boat International, really, because obviously we cover superyachts and they have a real expertise in the smaller boat sector. So it's a nice fit for the portfolio. So that's really exciting news heading into 2022, the growth of the kind of the Boat International Media portfolio. And there's brilliant teams come across from IBI as well. So we're very excited to have them join the team. And talking about some industry stuff, Sophia. So the final update on the brokerage number for 2021. I know we popped some champagne a couple of podcasts ago because my prediction of 650 sales for 2021 was closer to the actual number than 640, which was your guess. It actually turns out we were both way out. I just checked Boat Pro and the number was 714.
Wow.
714. That's likely to change a few because some deals are closed in the calendar year of 2021, but kind of announced in 2022 in January typically. So the number will probably change a few, but it won't be far off 714. And just to provide some historical context for just how outrageous that number is, the best previous year for brokerage sales was in 2018, and the number was 432. Let me just check my numbers here. Yeah, so 432. And we all thought that was a bumper brokerage year, 2021, 714. So not just a record year in by a few sales, a record year by 282 sales. So it's kind of hard to see how that relentless pace can be maintained, but I'm sure the brokerage community will be doing their best to make sure it is. I guess we'll see. But Sophia, care to take a punt on the final 2022 number?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I've already lost once. I need to up my game for this year. It can't continue, surely. I can't work out the economics of it, but it can't continue. So I'm going to say slightly more. I'm going to take your guess from last year, so I'm going to say 650.
I'm going to be a bit more conservative than that. I'm going to say between 500 and 550. That's my band. I just can't
Can't have a
see.
band. That's cheating.
Okay, 525. I'm going to say 525. I can't see another year like 2021. I just think the stock of brokerage boats, it will decrease or has decreased. There's just not much stock to soak up that demand. And also, I think we'll see 2021 really as an anomalous year when we're looking back through the record. But it should still be a good year. And even if we end 2022 at 525, in again, in a historical context, that's still a very positive year for the brokerage market. So I'm going to be a bit more. I'm going to be a bit more conservative, 525. But we'll see. I could be very, very wrong.
We'll have to get Charlotte's guess next week as well.
Yeah, make it a three-way bet. All right, another bottle of champagne on the line.
Well, we all know how that ended last time.
We'll see how that goes. We'll see how that goes a bit later this year. All righty, let's talk through some news before we do to this week's data story. And Sophia, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, so I'm starting with a story which actually came in before Christmas, but it's definitely significant, so I feel we should mention it, and that is that the Italian Sea Group has been awarded Perini Navi for 80 million euros. In an announcement made on December the 22nd, the Italian Sea Group confirmed its bid had been accepted at the auction held at Lucas Quarter Flore. As part of the deal, the Italian Sea Group has been awarded the industrial and real estate assets of the shipyards in Viareggio and La Spezia, the building complex in Pisa, and the 47-metre sailing yacht project 2369, currently under construction. Also included are all the trademarks and patents, as well as the social participation of the Perini Navi USA Incorporation and any existing legal relationships with employees and third parties. In a statement, the company said it was extremely satisfied with the acquisition, claiming the addition of Perini Navi perfectly integrates with its growth strategy and its competencies in the sailing yacht sector. The Italian Sea Group's founder and chief executive, Giovanni Constantino, added that the acquisition of Perini Navi's production spaces will enable the group to increase its incoming orders for the future, an ambition which is already coming to fruition after the Italian Sea Group announced it had received two orders for sailing yachts in December 2021. Stu, it's great to see that Perini Navi's got a new owner.
Yeah, it was something, you know, it was real. It was real intrigue and excitement around that, because, you know, it wasn't, you know, they weren't the only shark in the pond, really, for this acquisition. Ferretti Group, San Lorenzo, I know Palumbo had some interest for a while. So, you know, it's just great news that Perini Navi has a future, and it's a fantastic family of owners, intellectual property, and the brand will live on, because, you know, it's a brilliant one. So interesting that the Italian Sea Group's picked it up. They're in something of a purple patch at the moment. They've got some great boats in build. They've got a very strong order book. They've had a few really, really good years. So it'd be interesting to watch what they do with the brand, because, you know, there's a lot of love out there for Perini Navi. Next up, we have a story about a superyacht collision. The owners of the 63-metre superyacht Utopia 4 say they are still waiting for answers following the boat's collision with a tanker. This happened on Christmas Eve, and the owner said they are terribly saddened by the incident as the investigations continue. The incident occurred at 10 p.m., approximately 15 miles north-northwest of New Providence Island. A statement immediately afterwards said that Utopia 4 rear-ended a 49-meter gas tanker named Tropic Breeze as it made passage for Great Stirrup Cay. The force of the collision pierced the stern of the tanker, which caused it to sink. All seven crew members on board Tropic Breeze were uninjured and were rescued from the stricken vessel by passing FedShip that responded to the distress call. A representative confirmed that Lauren and J.R. Ridinger, the owners of Utopia 4, were out of the country when the collision occurred and that the yacht was on charter. In a statement, the pair said, "We are still waiting for answers ourselves and for the investigation as to both vessels' actions leading up to the collision to be completed. We are grateful that there were no serious injuries on either vessel and that the other vessel's cargo was non-persistent materials." Christmas Eve collision, how about that? So never good to see this. And yeah, some of the pictures are pretty shocking, and the tanker sank. So I guess we'll have to wait and see what the investigation concludes when that's eventually published.
Yeah, I don't understand enough about the technicalities of steering either a tanker or a superyacht for that matter, but it does seem quite shocking that that can happen, you know, just in the Bahamas. You sort of wouldn't think it was possible, really. But yeah, I'm sure the investigation will bring more to light what happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
So moving on, Heesen has announced the launch of its latest 50-metre steel displacement superyacht named Project Aura. The sub 500 GT superyacht, also known as Y9-19650, hit the water at Heesen's Oss facility ahead of Christmas on December 17th. Project Aura features an automotive-inspired design penned by Clifford Den, paired with a Scandinavian chic interior designed by Raymond Langton. Due for delivery at the end of April, the yacht is described as a true blue water motor yacht, ideal for extended cruising by the yard. The owner's representative, Captain Billy Lockhart, said, "The launch has always been the most important milestone in a boat's history, ever since sailors first went to sea. For us as the new crew, the pride and excitement we feel watching this new build take shape is no different. We look forward to the boat's completion and the voyages and experience we will have in store together."
Congratulations to Heesen. They've had a great year. They had a great 2021. Then again, you know, talk about yards with strong order books. They're another one. The new build industry is in a very good place right now, as revealed in our global order book report in the January issue, which obviously you've all read by now. If not, it's also available online. Record numbers of boats in build. There, all very good. So Lastly, this week, we end with a catamaran story. Of course we do. So Rossi Navi has released details of its new 40-meter fully electric catamaran concept. This is a really cool looking boat. It's called the Sea Cap 40. The aluminium catamaran was developed in collaboration with Fulvio Di Simone Yacht Design. So solar panels on the upper deck supply the Sea Cap 40 with the daily electric consumption of 6 average American homes. Wow. Powering the concept via battery banks to a range of 3,850 nautical miles at 8 knots. According to the yard, the concept can cruise continuously for 20 days, while a centralized AI system maintains the battery's charge status between 40 and 80%, helping to preserve power. Speaking about the concept, Rossi Navi's chief operating officer, Federico Rossi, said the idea was to create a link between nature, electricity, and futurism. Adding, while prioritizing the environment, the Sea Cap 40 is still able to offer excellent performance. It's a milestone for the shipyard. So if, like me, you're a true believer in the multi-hull form, go and commission Rossi Navi to build the fully electric Sea Cap 40. That, if all those environmental claims stack up, that will be a real watershed for the industry. Fully electric, 40-meter catamaran, motor catamaran. Wow. Please, somebody commit. That would be very, very cool.
It would ruin the podcast, though, because it would be all you'd ever talk about forevermore at every stage of the build.
We'd have to create a splinter podcast just to follow the build of CCAT 40. Me and 3 listeners. It wouldn't matter. I'd be so happy. All right, let's talk some data. And as ever, the data story is brought to you by Boat Pro, the superyacht industry's leading market intelligence service. Take it away, Sophia.
So this week, rather than looking at the superyacht fleet, which we tend to do, we thought we'd look at the crew that helped keep the fleet running. So with just over 11,000 yachts in the fleet, looking at the average numbers, we can estimate that 46,947 crew are on board during the low season. And this then goes up to a staggering 87,664 during high season.
And we should add at this point, so I often get asked why our figures don't always tally with some other people from the industry, because we start counting from 24 metres. We consider a superyacht as 24 metres and above, whereas some others start counting from 30 metres, I guess because it's a nice round number, but because MCA rules require that you hold a commercial qualification to pilot a superyacht that's 24 meters and above, we start at that threshold. So we count the market between 24 and 30 meters, where many others don't. And obviously a lot of action happens in that 6 meters between 24 and 30 meters. So that's why we say there are over 11,000 superyachts over 24 meters on the water.
So looking a bit more closely at the breakdown, if you look sort of at the yacht sizes, so if you take between 60 and 70 metres, of which there are 200 in the fleet, in the low season, the average 12 crew on board, and this increases to 18 during the high season. So this size category alone is employing 3,600 crew members. And then when you go to the top end of the market, 100 metre plus, where there are 55 yachts, the average member of crew is 50 during the low season, and this then increases to 70 during the high season, which means that this size category is employing 3,850 crew during these time periods. Where this starts to get even more interesting is when you look at projects on order under construction. We're estimating that more than 1,000 yachts are currently in that process, which means that an extra 10,426 crew will be required on board these vessels, which I think can mean if you add another couple of years on that, we're not far away from seeing 100,000 superyacht crew. I mean, it's a vast number, and I guess it also throws up the question, will there be enough qualified or experienced crew to fill these roles?
Yeah, well, I think that ultimately there will be, where there's a demand and, you know, when conditions are right, I mean, those roles will be filled, but, you know, they're not there at the moment. Obviously, there's a lot of people need to come into the industry to fill all those roles, but it's a very attractive life if you're a young person looking to, you know, make quite a lot of money quite quickly. Then the superyacht industry is a great place to be and have some great fun doing it.
You're keen to get the Campbell crew enlisted as soon as
they're
old enough.
When my oldest daughter's 13 now, so when she's a bit older, I'll absolutely be pushing her in that direction, because I think you can have an awful lot of fun have some great adventures. And if you're on the right boat with the right owner and the right program, it's the best way to spend a couple of years. But I know there's a bit of a crew shortage at the moment. There's, heavy demand for crew, especially as many more bigger boats are being built. When you've suddenly got a crew up, 50, 60 people to staff a, 120, 130 meter boat, that's very, very difficult to do. But as demand increases, conditions improve, and rotation becomes more of a factor. Salaries improve, which is to the benefit of everyone, really. So I think it's to think that in a couple of years there'll be 100,000 superyacht crew on the water is pretty amazing, really. But it just goes to show you how much the industry's grown in the last 15, 20 years. It's become huge, much, much bigger.
I guess one plus side of it as well is that that will mean there's many more seasons of Below Deck for you to watch, Stuart. So your watching is safe for the years to come.
Although it's a problem though. It's so absorbing. I have to stop. I need to curb this habit.
If you're ignoring my messages in the evening, I'm gonna know why now. It's just because you're just in a Below Deck
I have to find out.
coma
I have
somewhere.
to. To be fair, my habit has only extended to two seasons of this show so far. I've got no idea how many seasons there are, like I said. So I guess I'll find out eventually. In that idle moment when you're wondering what to watch, you just bung on Below Deck. Anyway, that's it for this week. Thanks, Sophia. Stick around for Charlotte's interview with one of the most fascinating superyacht owners going, Victor Vescovo.
I'm joined today by Explorer vessel owner and explorer Victor Vescovo. Victor owns the deep submergence support vessel Pressure Drop and the full ocean depth capable Triton submarine Limiting Factor. I'm very privileged to be speaking with Victor today as he only very recently came off a dive, and this wasn't any dive either. This was to the deepest point of the Kermadec Trench in the South Pacific Ocean, which has a calculated depth of 10,003 metres. It was the last of the world's four 10,000 plus metre trenches that he had not yet dived, making him the first person ever to dive all four of the world's 10,000 metre trenches. Amazing stuff. We're going to hear more about that later. But firstly, Victor, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you very much for having me.
I feel like it could be early in the morning where you are due to the time difference. Hopefully it's about 9 a.m. where you are.
Yeah, it's not that bad. It's only 9 a.m. Still under jet lag. I'm still on South Pacific Auckland time, but no worries.
God, yeah, I bet. Well, you look very fresh. Thank you for making the effort fresh from your journey.
No worries.
So before we start, I wondered, we've obviously met before, but for people listening who don't know anything about you, I wondered if you could introduce yourself a bit say a bit about this extraordinary journey that you've been on for the past, I'm not sure when it began, 5 years, longer than 5 years ago?
Well, it depends on when you consider the start, whether it was the development and research on building the submersible or actually building it or going on the dive. So more or less 4 or 5 years, sure.
And so explain a bit about what you've done and your plans.
Sure. My name is Victor Vescovo, and I've been living in Dallas, Texas since I was born here a long time ago. And I was in the U.S. Navy for about 20 years as an intelligence officer. I had a career as well in finance and private equity, and was fortunate enough to do pretty well there, where I was able to enjoy a multi-decade career in mountain climbing and most recently in deep ocean exploration. And so 5 years ago, I worked with Triton Submarines to develop the first commercially rated full ocean depth submersible. And with that, we were able to undertake the Five Deeps expedition to go to the bottom of all five of the world's oceans, which had never been done before. But since that was completed in 2019, I've been using the past 3 years, despite COVID, to continue our scientific and mapping missions all over the world, where we've been able to dive in many of the major trenches of the world, and we're continuing to do that today.
I mean, that is just incredible. I'm going to skip forward to one of my questions that I was planning on asking a lot later, seeing as you brought it up. But, it is incredible what you've been doing considering COVID. How much of an issue has it been for you in terms of carrying out what you'd planned to do? Have you had to change your plans? Have you had staff shortages? All this sort of thing.
Have we had to change our plans? Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I said that knowing what the answer would be, I think.
Yeah, it certainly complicated things significantly. Mm. But like so many things in life, you can't just give up. And we went through all the iterations with different governments and the constantly changing regulations, including getting back into the United States just in the past week and being able to actually, you know, get crew on board. And we adjusted our missions to fit the timing and the requirements, but you just work the problem. And I know many of the people listening to this that have the operations and other complicated expeditions, you just work the problem. And there's very little that can actually stand in the way if you just put your mind to it and you it work with people.
Yeah. So persistence, I guess, and like you say, adjusting to things. Yes. But let's talk a bit about your latest dive. Kind of, did that go to plan? Were there any obstacles that you weren't expecting, challenges and things, or was it all pretty smooth?
No, it was not smooth. Unfortunately, we had a situation where we were operating in the South Pacific, and we originally planned to go to Australia and New Zealand, but they had a lockdown in Australia. And so we actually were forced, including myself, to quarantine for 2 weeks at sea, where previously I was just going to fly into Australia and meet the ship in the submersible. But instead, I had to fly to Guam and then spend 14 calendar days on the ship doing nothing except mapping the seafloor and undergoing quarantine so we could stop and not even set foot in Australia. But just because we were docked, we had to be in quarantine and then pick up the submersible and then continue our operations. So we were able, once we were at sea, to do everything we wanted to do. The ship and the submersible performed beautifully, but all the restrictions around COVID just lengthened the mission and caused us a lot of logistical difficulties. But again, you work the problem and you take the hit and you do what you have to do to get the mission done.
Amazing. And what was it like? You know, I find it incredible when you talk about these depths, you know, presumably you don't see very much down there. So what do you do when you're 10,000 meters, you know, at the bottom of the ocean?
Well, we do see quite a bit. I mean, one of the major, we have extremely powerful lights all over the submersible. We have high definition cameras rolling. And the best comparison I can make of the ultra deep places we go in excess of 8,000 meters is they're like the deserts of the deep ocean. It's not that they're lifeless, and they certainly aren't as colorful as the sea, you know, 500 meters or shallower, but they do have very unique and specialized life. For example, just on this most recent expedition, the cameras on board the submersible were able to catch a comb jellyfish at 10,003 meters, which is, we believe, might be the deepest jellyfish ever recorded. And the fact that it is surviving down there under more than 7 tons of pressure and freezing temperatures is just, that's extraordinary life. Mm. It's not abundant, but really these are scientific missions. And we were finding evidence of chemosynthetic bacterial mats on the rocks. It was extremely volcanic. It's just a very different environment than one typically anticipates. And it can look a bit more sterile to some people, but scientifically it's fascinating.
Mm. And I guess if you know what you're looking for, there's a whole load of stuff that is fascinating to see.
Exactly. Especially many of our geologists that work with us were looking at some of the original video from this dive in particular, and it was just incredibly violent, volcanic, and shattered areas and things that they've never been able to see before as a sub is moving through the terrain. Typically, they drop a lander down, which can only look around 20 meters where it is. They can't actually go and investigate things or do a long multi-mile transect to actually see what the terrain is like. And so we're opening a new window into the deep ocean floor, which is something that it was designed to do.
Yeah, it's incredible. And how long does each dive actually last, kind of logistically, in terms of how long you can spend down there?
On the bottom, we can typically spend anywhere between 2 and 4 hours, depending on what the terrain is like and whether or not we can get a lot of good science out of it. But normally it'll take on a full ocean depth dive to the bottom of Challenger Deep, it can take 3.5 to 4 hours to get to the bottom and 4 hours to come up. And when you add 2 to 4 hours on the bottom, you're talking about a mission time of about 10 to 12 hours minimum on some of these really, really deep dives. When you're in a two-person submersible that's about a little over a meter wide, that can get a little bit cramped. And it gets quite cold in the submersible because you're basically sitting in a large metal sphere. But that's normal for deep ocean submarine operations.
Yeah. And how do you, presumably you have like protective clothing and stuff that kind of helps mitigate that, or do you just huddle together for warmth?
Yeah, we basically do a little bit of both, but we have typical, you know, fleece and hats and gloves. We have heaters on board and we can heat the capsule up reasonably well, but that eats into the battery life, which powers the thrusters. So it's a trade-off between mission duration and physical comfort.
So When you're doing all these kind of world firsts like you are, presumably there are some kind of unknowns that you have to deal with, or what are the sort of factors you have to take into consideration when you're going somewhere which isn't well explored like you have been?
Well, that basically cuts into two areas. One is technical and the other one is operational. And by that, I mean, in the early days of employing the submersible, it was very much a prototype. It had never been designed or built before or operated in these extraordinary environments. So we were troubleshooting systems, but that's what you do with a prototype device. And over the past several years, we've been able to perfect it where that's really not an issue anymore. So now it's more of operational issues, which are, okay, now that we're on the bottom, are we in the place where we thought we were going to be because of drift? And what are interesting things that we see that we want to go investigate operationally? Are there other things that, you know, could derail operation in terms of, you know, where we are, or a wall that's in front of us, or an overhang, and taking care of those issues? But those are pretty minor now. It's really just really enjoyable to be able to pick any point on the seafloor, go down there and investigate it. And these are places that no human being has ever been to. And so typically we are finding new things all the time.
And how, when you're sort of talking about what happens when you get down there, how kind of spontaneous can you be? Is everything very carefully planned, or can you go down there and say, actually, you know, we weren't where we thought we were, but let's have a look around anyway. It's cool.
I think that's a great question, one that hasn't really been asked me before, but it actually highlights the fact that a manned submersible is extremely versatile and can be very spontaneous, unlike, completely unlike, an AUV or an autonomous underwater vehicle or a even remotely operated vehicle. And I think they all complement one another. But those devices that people say, why do you need a manned submersible when an automated or a remote operating vehicle can go down cheaper and maybe even safer, which is absolutely not the case. And the issue is that an AUV has to be programmed on exactly what it's going to do. And it has to be programmed very conservatively so that it can stay out of trouble. Same with an ROV. They're relatively slow and they certainly can get in danger if they go into complicated environments with overhangs or even a wreck dive where there are cables and things like that. And there was a famous ROV called the Nereus that the Woods Hole Institute produced that actually was lost in the trench that I just dove with a manned submersible. So the manned submersible.
You didn't fancy bringing it back for them. They didn't say, hey, while you're down there, if you see one of my things, can you pick
it up? I actually looked for some of the wreckage of it, but I didn't see it. It's a big place. But a manned submersible is incredibly safe, and we are able to your point, dynamically go spot, you know, anywhere we want to. We see something interesting, we can go there. We can go up, down, all around. And because we're right there in the moment, we have spatial awareness and we can avoid any obstacles. We can move quickly and we can move slowly. So it's an incredibly versatile scientific and observational instrument that I think is in many respects superior to an autonomous or remotely operated vehicle. It complements what they do. They're great for broad ocean surveillance, and then we can go and pinpoint and dynamically interact with the environment.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And do you always agree on exactly what you want to go and investigate further? Because presumably when you're doing these dives, you have scientists, you have you know, do you always go after the same things, or is there sometimes a bit of a tug of love for which direction you're heading?
Sometimes, but generally it follows the same mission profile where we're trying to go to the very deepest points to some of these trenches just because we want to see what's down there. Is there something surprising in terms of marine biology or geology? And then typically we will do what we call a transect, where I think most scientists agree that what they really just want us to do is to cover as much ground as possible so that they have the greatest chance of finding something new and unusual. And so that's what we do. We go on a line. Or if we go up to a major wall, we'll try and stay along the wall for a long period of time so we can cover more ground, not just laterally, but also vertically. It's really just about trying to cover as much ground as possible so we can capture on video everything we can. And then there's a long process of analyzing all the video, sometimes frame by frame, to see if there's anything remarkable in that footage that is unique to that trench.
So that's quite cool then. So you don't necessarily, you know, come back from a dive thinking that was amazing. It might be a significant time afterwards that you suddenly pick up on, oh, that was the day that we actually discovered this incredible thing.
Right. It kind of works in two phases. Immediately upon getting up, people are always, you know, coming around me saying, what did you see? What did you see? And I'm pulling out my phone that I usually use as backup in case some of the cameras fail. And I'm showing him, here's what I saw. This is what it actually looks like. Because especially the sonar operators are always seeing a sonar map, but they're curious, what does it actually look like? Yeah. What color is it? How rocky? That kind of thing. But then over the next several days or even weeks, the team will go through all the footage. And then sometimes they'll surprise me saying, hey, Victor, do you know what you caught on camera? I said, no, I have no idea. They go, look, you got this jellyfish. And I'll be like, wow, that's great. But that's why the cameras are so important, is because they will capture things that if my head is inside the submarine doing something, I might miss it, but they don't miss a thing.
Yeah, I never thought about it until you're saying, asking people to describe it. But in a way, it's a bit like going into space or something, right? Like you're going somewhere no one's ever seen, and you're the kind of ambassador to report back. Does that ever feel kind of pressurizing or a bit weird that you're the one that's kind of in charge of seeing this stuff and telling everyone else about it?
No, it feels like a great privilege, because we are essentially doing true exploration. And in the year 2021, almost 22, who gets to do that? Pretty much the entire terrestrial world has been thoroughly explored or mapped by satellites or these things, but the deep ocean remains relatively impenetrable. But now that we have this tool, I have the great privilege of being able to take it to places no human's ever been and being on the forefront of true exploration, going into these deep trenches. And so I feel very privileged to be, hopefully, you know, someone in the long line of explorers going back to the, you know, 14th century that went into places that were completely unknown. So it's a great feeling, and there's no real pressure. It's really just a joy more than anything else.
And how do you feel before these dives? Is it nervousness? Is it excitement? You know, what's if I was to meet you 5 minutes before a massive dive, what state are you in?
Well, it follows the earlier answer that it's kind of gone in two phases over the last 3 or 4 years, where early on it was much more of a technical issue. And I wouldn't say there was any real fear or even anxiety. It was more just concern, I guess, because in many respects, I'm now certified as a submersible test pilot. That's what we were doing in the early days, where we were just going through system after system and troubleshooting and figuring how to make it better. So it was much more of a technical dive. So there was some degree of apprehension there and just making sure that everything worked well and how to fix it on the fly if something didn't go as expected. But later, now that the submersible is extremely reliable and very, very safe, it's more about what do we see outside the submersible and how do we dynamically interact with the environment. A great example was when we did the deepest wreck dive in history earlier this year at the site of the USS Johnston in the Philippine Trench. And that was incredibly dynamic because no one had ever seen this wreck before, and we had no idea what to expect or even exactly where it was. So finding it was a huge, exciting moment, but then actually surveying the wreck with the submersible, going up and down its port and starboard sides and videoing as much as possible, trying to figure out what happened to it during the battle, that was very dynamic. But it was also, wreck dives can be quite challenging and a little bit dangerous because literally pieces of metal are jutting out of it, and with limited visibility in submersible, you have to be a bit careful. So those are very dynamic dives, but they're also extremely exciting and very, very rewarding.
Yeah, I find your language interesting. You say dynamic. I would say vaguely terrifying, but we'll go with dynamic. Have you ever had any kind of close shaves? Or I think you once mentioned there was a what you call a thermal event when you were down in the sub. You know, what sort of things have happened that haven't been quite to plan?
Well, in the early days, this submersible was a prototype, and we were taking it to an extraordinary set of circumstances in terms of pressure and temperature and these types of things. So in the Tonga Trench, which is the second deepest trench in the world, I was actually on the bottom. I was flying the submersible solo as the pilot. And one of the circuit breakers on the outside of the submersible controlling one of the batteries had a fault. It actually had a very small amount of water ingress, but it caused a short. And it caused that particular battery to just start dumping its enormous amount of electric potential. And it actually started what on the surface in ambient atmosphere would have been a small little fire, let's just call it that. But under 8 tons of water pressure, it was just an extreme level of heat, and it actually caused the battery to have a significant issue. But I got the warnings and I did what I'm supposed to do, and I shut down that area of the submersible. I isolated the issue just like you would in a plane. And I'm a pilot as well, so I just went through the procedures, isolated it, and I actually continued the dive for another hour on the bottom. Because I looked at all the other systems and they were all green and the sub was healthy except for that one battery. I was able to achieve the mission at the Horizon Deep and investigate it. And then I came up 4 hours later and we dealt with the issue and it's never happened again. But that's what you do. You know.
Very calm under pressure. Why are you not an astronaut? It's written all over you.
Thanks. Well, I'd like to be.
Yeah, would you? Would that be a thing in the future if you know, once you've done all the 10,000 deep dives, you think maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. Space? Yeah, I've actually gotten my reservation number on Virgin Galactic.
Have you?
I'm now number 600 in line to go up. But hopefully that means maybe sometime in 2024, I hope, I'll get to go up into space. But that's always been an ambition.
Well, I hope next podcast you can tell me all about what you discovered in space. But back to your back to all the kind of kit you have. I was thinking you must have some pretty cutting edge technology with in terms of what you're doing and the cameras and the submarine and everything. What's the kind of coolest thing you have on board that people might not know about, you know, might not know even exists?
Goodness, we have so many different things because so much of the technology is completely new. When you're going to full ocean depth, or basically 11,000 meters, you can't go to a hardware store and just buy stuff from that section of the hardware store. It's all custom made. So we have high definition, and even the first 4K camera that was designed to operate at full ocean depth. So we have that, which is extraordinary.
And we was also that designed especially for you and what you were doing? Yeah.
Wow. So that had never really been deployed before. We also have three semi-robotic landers that go down with the submersible, and they actually act as navigation beacons, but they also have cameras, they have the ability to collect samples, all sorts of different things. And so those are kind of the unsung heroes of the expedition, because without them I really wouldn't know where I was on the bottom of the seafloor. And I'm able to triangulate my position on the seafloor using them. So we do a lot of math, and we have some custom applications that we've designed that are able to dynamically identify where the submersible is on the seafloor real time, and helps us a lot with navigation. So a lot of this is very technical, kind of nerdy stuff, but that's essential when you don't have access to the surface, where you have GPS, where you have clear communications. Everything is much more difficult down under the water. For example, people don't often realize it takes 7 seconds each way for a sound transmission to go from the surface to the submersible.
Really?
So just to communicate to the surface, if they're trying to get a message to me and a response from me, round trip, it takes 14 seconds, which is longer than it takes for a radio signal to go to the moon and back. So you really are in a very isolated place, and it's very faint, and you have a lot of technology to process that signal so it's even intelligible on the headset.
How do you communicate? What is it that sends the message up to them?
It's a modem that was designed originally for military use between submarines. It's quite high power because you are trying to transmit through 7 miles of water that has all sorts of different characteristics. But it's basically a sound modem that's powered by electrical transmissions with a lot of digital signal processing built into the circuitry. And we also can communicate by text. And we've learned that that's actually essential, because when you're that deep down, it can be very difficult to hear non-standard phraseology, new words. They can get a bit garbled. But texting with its error correction is fantastic, because if there's something complicated going on, I can just put it in a text and they're like, oh, okay, that's what's happening.
I love the idea of you just firing off texts like small fire, all good, thumbs up.
No, but I'm trying to give the position of where the submersible is on the bottom so they can predict where I'm going to come up. I can give an exact location. I'm this many meters away on this bearing from this lander. And then they get it very clearly via text versus trying to decipher it, you know, 10 times over a voice communication from seven miles down.
And you clearly have the most incredible team around you, or a team that even seems like too small a word. You know, this is these are major operations. There's a huge number of people involved, both in terms of the technology, the planning, the logistic, all this sort of thing. But I wondered, you know, it's a common thing among owners with, you know, small private yachts that they struggle to get the right staff and all the rest of it. Do you think you naturally get incredibly talented people working on this because it's such an exciting thing that you're doing? Or is there a certain kind of filtering process you have to make sure you're hiring the right people and you have the support you need around you?
It's a bit of both. I was fortunate early in the expedition to work with both Triton Submarines as well as EOS Expeditions. And they're some of the best in their respective fields. And so much of it worked on referral. And when we were recruiting for the Five Deeps expedition, so many people were interested in this particular mission because it is so cutting edge. So you benefit from both. You have people that know the right people that are going to be motivated and highly skilled, but then also they wanted to come as well because they wanted to be part of the mission. And that just continued with our scientific mission going forward. In fact, I was talking to one of my crew members on the ship and I was asking him, you know, what is it like working on the ship and just trying to get a feel for the overall morale. He said, oh, Victor, you need to understand, this is like the unicorn assignment for a mariner. Yeah. Because we're not under profit pressure or intense time, and it's not just a luxury vessel where it's just about having a good time. We're doing things for science and for many respects, historical achievements. At the same time, you're working for an owner operator that can make decisions quickly, that can fund the vessel and get what they need. And they said, this is just a great team to be a part of. It's a happy ship.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to hear. So now you've done the five deeps, and then you've done these dives to, so it's the four 10,000 meter trenches, so the Mariana, Tonga, Philippine, and Kamadic trenches. So you've done stage two. How do you feel? Is it a bit, are you at a bit of a loss now you've finished, or is it a relief to be back on dry land? What's the overall feeling?
It's kind of like in mountaineering, you have the ever receding ridge problem, which is every ridge that you get to the top of, you see another one. So
yeah.
You certainly
okay.
feel a sense of accomplishment, and it does feel great to have done all the 10,000 meter trenches as well as the five deeps. But 80% of the world's ocean is completely unexplored, and we still have many very deep ocean trenches that have never been explored with a manned submersible or sometimes even an ROV. And therefore, yes, it feels great to have done what we just did, but the ship is headed off to the coast of Latin America, and we're going to attempt to do the first crewed descents of the Atacama Trench off of Chile, and then the Mid-America Trench off Mexico. Those have never had a human being go down there and do a long transect. So for every accomplishment that we do, there's always something very new and interesting to explore on the seafloor. And then hopefully next April or May, we're hoping to go to the Midway battlefield site and actually the first crewed descents to the aircraft carriers that were lost at the Battle of Midway. And that'll be fascinating as an amateur naval historian. In fact, no one's even imaged with video the Akagi, the flagship of the Japanese fleet that led the attack on Pearl Harbor. And we're hoping to make the first descent and video capture of that incredibly famous ship. And then we're going to continue on with other trenches that have never had manned dives. So one's off the coast of Japan, the Manila Trench off the Philippines. Like I said, there's always something new to explore in the ocean because it is so untouched.
Yeah. I mean, how do you, well, two questions. One is the ship that you were describing, do you know exactly where it is, or is that going to be a bit of trial and error? And the next question was just, given there is so much to explore, how do you possibly choose where to go next?
Well, in the first,
you know, you issue, said it yourself, 80% yeah. of the world, you know, how do you just stick a pin in a map and hope for the best, or?
That can be a little bit like that. I think Rob McCallum, my expedition leader, said one of the most dangerous things in the world is to give me some time by myself in a map. So I kind of look, where is the ship and what's interesting around there? So it can be as simple as that, which is what's unexplored. Well, let's go there. We're in the neighborhood kind of thing. But with respect to, you know, finding things like the wreck, one thing that we're constantly doing is building new technology. For example, we are in the process of developing, and we've just finished testing what we believe is the first side scan sonar that's qualified for full ocean depth, which means we can mount this on the submersible and have maybe a 1 to 1.5 kilometer wide sonar scan capability for the deep ocean floor. Right now, I think the limit is about 6,000 meters, but this we could take even further. So that will hopefully allow us to find man-made objects on the seafloor at any depth, which is a technology that we don't believe has ever existed before that we know of. But being able to test it and take it on these exciting missions, that's part of the fun now, is actually pushing the technological limits further, because that's really what it started out as, was a technological mission to build a reusable, safe, commercially certified submersible that could go to full ocean depth, which had never existed before. But now we have that. Now we're not just using it for science and other exploration, but we're pushing the technology even further for all of its accoutrements.
God, it's so exciting to think what's kind of ahead of you, and you've already done so much amazing stuff. But what you've achieved so far, what are you most proud of? And is there a moment that you can pinpoint as, you know, that was a great day, or I remember that feeling, that was one of the moments when it was all worthwhile?
Yeah, I definitely think that making the first descent of this submersible to the bottom of Challenger Deep, being only the fourth person to do so, that was the real moment where we realized, wow, we actually developed and built this new technology. And at that point, we had no question at all that it was going to be able to do it repeatedly. And we did 4 dives to the bottom of Challenger Deep in 10 days, and no one had even remotely come close to doing that. So that was a real big achievement for the whole team of, you know, reaching that huge milestone. So that was a real high point.
And you always sound very positive in terms of the challenges that come up, whether they're technological, whether they're COVID. Have you had a bad day at the office where you just thought, oh, why am I doing this? This is a lot of hassle. Or is it just always something you're kind of pushing through and making happen?
Well, you're definitely always in the mode trying to push through. The most powerful force humans have is our ability just to persist, even in the midst of adversity. And we certainly had some rough moments, particularly in the very early days when we were testing not just the submersible, but also the ship and the personnel and our procedures. Everything seemed to have its own rough spot. So yeah, there was a couple of days. It's documented in the book that was written about the Five Deeps, where off the Puerto Rican trench, we were testing the submersible. And yeah, the manipulator arm, a very expensive piece of kit, actually came off the submersible. That was not a good day. And then on the surface, when I was exiting the submersible, I actually fell into the water. So I was soaking wet. It was not one of the most enjoyable days. But in a great ironic twist, the fact that the manipulator came off freed up a bank of circuits that we were then able to use to solve other issues we were having, that then allowed us to perfect the sub for that particular dive and allowed us to go to the bottom of the Atlantic. And so we learned a great deal from it. We were able to adjust and still accomplish the mission. And so you just continue to adapt. And yeah, it was a really, really rough day and we stressed a lot of people, but we got it done.
And I'm curious because we obviously have lots of, you know, owners of private yachts that are very different from what you're doing on this podcast. Do you feel like a super yacht owner? If someone describes you as a super yacht owner, do you feel like that sums you up, or do you feel quite separate from that whole community? Or is there a bit of overlap?
Yeah, I must confess, I feel very separate from that community. In fact, You see people look at the pressure drop and the limiting factor, oh, you have a super yacht. Say, no, it's not a yacht at all. It is a working class vessel. It's a former U.S. Navy military vessel with the kind that I used to serve on. So it is not luxury by any stretch of the imagination. And when people hear the word yacht, they think of luxury and pleasure cruise. And that's not at all what this ship and what this mission is about. So I have a cabin on the ship, but it's nothing special. We have no teak service. We don't have people delivering. We all eat in the same common mess. We don't have fine linen, but it's a working vessel. And I'm very proud of that fact. And when I'm on the ship, I'm down there with everybody else. I'm part of the crew. I'm the submersible pilot. And yeah, I'm treated that way. And, you know, if we need to change direction of the ship or do something, yeah, I'm now the owner and go into that mode. But it's a very different feeling. And so it's a research vessel. It's not really a yacht.
Yeah. And do you ever meet owners of Explorer yachts doing kind of other sort of more, I mean, it pales into comparison with what you're doing, but you know, you meet someone that goes to the Svalbard or the Northwest Passage and stuff. Do you find you have more in common with them, or likewise not, you don't really cross paths too much?
I do. One of the great friends that I've made in this industry has been Vince Pierboni, who is the leader of the Ocean X team.
Yeah.
That have that incredible ship, the Ocean Explorer, that's funded by Ray Dalio and his team. And that is like the Starship Enterprise. It has incredibly modern and high-tech equipment, including a media room. It has things that we do not have on my vessel. They have submarines. They have ROVs, they have amazing things. So that is a super yacht. It's luxurious, has a helicopter pad, you know, all these wonderful things. So I admire that, but they also do real hardcore science. And so in many respects, they are what we do on steroids, but at shallower depth. We are a very specialized asset that is dedicated to ultra deep ocean exploration. That's our niche and that's what we do. And we do it in a very kind of blue collar way, but that's kind of how I am and that's what I like doing.
I love that. So you've said that mapping the seafloor is a kind of big part of your expeditions. How has that part of the mission been going? Because you presumably you've got a good bank of data now, having, you know, being a few years into the project.
Yeah, it was funny when we first got the start to the Five Deeps expedition, my scientific team somewhat late in the process said, well, you know, Victor, we don't actually know where the deepest point in each of the five oceans are. I went, you've got to be kidding me. Certainly so know that.
Wait, what?
Yeah, isn't it in Wikipedia or something? And you know, they laughed and they said, no, you're going to have to invest in a very high-end sonar to actually identify these places. And by the way, given that they're so deep, it's going to be very difficult. So we were able to find through Kongsberg that they had just developed the EM124 sonar suite, which is the most advanced sonar system currently available. And we got serial number one. So we not only installed that on the ship, we actually were the team that qualified it and got all the bugs out of it with Kongsberg. But now it's an incredible tool. And now I think there are more than 20 or even 30 of them deployed worldwide because they are such a great system to use. But because we're crisscrossing all over the world to these deep ocean trenches, we are able to map areas of the seafloor that no one's ever been before. So at this point, I think we're up to 1.5, maybe even getting close to 2 million square kilometers of new seafloor being mapped for the first time, or even if it has been mapped, it's now mapped with a higher resolution than has ever been done before. One of the proudest moments I had on the mapping front was when we went to the Southern Ocean and we dove in the South Sandwich Trench. No one had remotely mapped any of that. And we mapped the entire length of the 1,000-mile long trench and were able to deliver that to JEBCO in support of their seabed 2030. And in a really cool twist, because we not only mapped it, but I dove it in a submersible limiting factor. I was actually given the right to name the deepest point in the Southern Ocean, and we named it after the submersible. So it is now officially known as the Factorian Deep.
Oh, very cool, very cool. And yeah. And what I was going to ask, what do you do with that data? Is that kind of open source for scientists to see, or do you submit it to, you mentioned the name of a body I hadn't heard before just now.
Yeah, so it's also open source, and I've made a commitment to the National Hydrographic Organization and to the JEBCO organization, which is supported by the Nippon Foundation, and their objective is to map the entire seafloor by the year 2030, which to say it's ambitious would be a great understatement. But people are pooling together, including some of my colleagues in the private research ocean vessel community, and we're doing our best to map as much as we can. And again, to my earlier comment about the niche that we fulfill, we go for the deep ocean trenches because those are hard to map and they're hard to survey. So that's what we focus on.
Certainly, I know if there are owners of smaller yachts listening, I know there are a number of various initiatives for private owners to also kind of help get on board with that and map stuff as they go and submit the data. You don't necessarily need to have a first serial number sonar piece of kit to do it if you're going somewhere less remote. But what are some of the amazing scientific discoveries you've made, especially from the more recent dives?
Right. Well, the interesting thing about the deep ocean trenches is because they are so remote and no one ever goes there, it seems that every time we make a dive, it's possible to have a new discovery. There can be what's called genetic drift between trenches because these deep ocean creatures can't really migrate from one to the other. So over millions of years, they may develop differently. So one thing that we're constantly trying to do is on video or where we have scientific permits, actually do collections and then do DNA sequencing of these creatures. So yeah, sometimes we actually see things that look very unusual. In fact, just on this most recent dive at the Kermadec Trench, I saw something I'd never seen before. They look like small brown squares on the seafloor, and they appear to have trails behind them. So at first I thought they were rocks, but they were distributed in such a way that it didn't look completely random. And immediately there's even discussion among my off-ship science team going, what are those? Mm. And we think they actually might be creatures instead of rocks. And so we're like, okay, well, that's interesting. So we're now analyzing the film in much more detail to see just what are those? Are those a genetic offshoot of a horseshoe crab type of creature, but it just has a different form? I don't know, frankly, at this point, but that's what's so exciting. In fact, one of the most exciting moments of the Five Deeps expedition after a dive in the Java Trench, we saw a creature come right across the video screen of one of the landers. And I turned to my chief scientist because it looked absolutely bizarre. It looked like a bizarre form of jellyfish. And I said, what is that? And he turned to me and he said, I don't know what the hell that is. Yeah. And those are great moments in exploration where you're literally finding things that the scientific community is like, I don't know what the heck that is. And you're trying to figure it out. But that's what makes it fun.
It's so fascinating. It's just like, when you think of those early explorers going on board to, lands undiscovered and having those sort of natural history workbooks where they'd be illustrating new creatures, it's straight out of that.
Yes, it reminds me when the first explorers went to Australia and they found the platypus.
Yes.
And when they described it, people said, well, that can't exist. And sometimes people comment when you go to the deep ocean trenches, well, they all look the same. Well, they're not the same, especially scientifically. They're all quite different. But when you're exploring, and I try to emphasize this point to people, is you don't know what you're going to find. And what we are trying to do so often is we're waiting. We're waiting to find something truly extraordinary. Every time we dive into these trenches where no one's been before, there's the possibility that we could run into a creature or a feature or something else that literally could be groundbreaking. And that does happen sometimes in exploration. Maybe we do, maybe we don't, but we are making the attempt and we are putting ourselves out there to cover as much ground as possible to make an extraordinary find hopefully possible.
It's amazing stuff. And what do you think drives you to do this? I mean, you obviously love to explore, and when you hear the things you've discovered, you think, well, obviously that sounds very cool, but it's easy to look at that and not look at all the hard work and time and money and everything that's gone into it. And I have a feeling that even if you weren't diving the bottom of the ocean, you'd be doing something wherever, you know, wherever you'd been born or whatever had happened. So do you think it's something in your background, or what do you think drives this kind of passion for discovery inside you?
I think it's a combination of things. Some of my favorite heroes in history, like, you know, an Amundsen or a Shackleton or others, there's got to be a genetic component. And I think some medical professionals have told me that people do have genetic propensities to either take risks or not take risks. And I think one of them commented that I was probably on one end of the spectrum in that regard. So I think part of it is genetic. It's within you that you just always are curious, 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 curious.
Mm. Were you like that even as a little kid? Like,
oh, yes, to the absolute horror to my poor parents. I was very precocious and very quiet. But when I got my first bicycle, that was just, the world opened up for me and I was able to go anywhere when I wanted to. And unfortunately, that meant quite a distance from my home, which terrified my poor parents.
Yeah.
But that goes to the other element of the equation, which was upbringing, whether that is encouraged and fostered and forgiven, or whether or not one is clamped down. And my parents were wonderful that they encouraged me to explore, not just physically, but also mentally through books, and encouraged me to read as much as possible in nonfiction, but also fiction, to develop this sense of wonder about our world and then wanting to go out and personally explore it. So I think it's a combination of nature and nurture.
And what do your family make of what you do now?
Well, unfortunately, both my parents have passed, but I have a wonderful sister and she is extremely supportive and she knows me extremely well and has often said that if I didn't do this, I'd feel like a caged animal. And so she's very happy that I get to indulge my passion for exploration and technological advancement.
And do you think she'd ever come down with you?
I'm not quite sure she will. It can be a little bit claustrophobic in the submersible. I don't know how comfortable she would be. Maybe on a short dive, we'll see.
Yeah, because you have, I remember last time we spoke, you said you were kind of hoping to sell tickets to some of these dives or to bring, kind of get sponsors for these. Did that happen? Did people come with you? And if so, what was that like, kind of sharing it with someone else?
Right. I think that's the best way to describe it. It's more of kind of a co-sponsorship, but operating the vessel and the submersible, as any yacht owner listening to this knows, is extremely expensive, especially when you're dealing with the levels of technology and crew support that you need for these missions. So I did advertise that I was looking for people to go down with me on some of the more iconic dives like the Challenger Deep. But what that really did was it allowed me to extend the science portion of these missions because of the expense involved. So I was very happy to take down other people that were able to provide support to the expedition, but they also got to see what it was like to go down to the bottom of the ocean. But during the missions, they were actually part of the crew. They were observing, they were helping me monitor the instruments, and that was essential because so many times you can get really busy down there when you're doing single pilot operation in the submersible at the bottom of the ocean. So in many respects, they were crew members that, again, were supporting the expedition. It's been a great partnership with all of them.
So, I mean, I had made a note to ask you what you're doing in the future. You've already outlined, you know, the places that you're hoping to go and the challenges of going there. So instead, I'll end on, seeing as this is going to be airing in the beginning of the new year. So when people are listening to this, we'll be fast forwarded through our COVID Christmas and it will be 2022. Do you have a New Year's resolution?
I guess the only real New Year's resolution I have is just to continue doing what I'm doing and hopefully being successful in the new technological developments like this new sonar system, but really just continuing to foster the camaraderie we have on the ship and the sub and continue to be able to fund it to continue exploring the world. I'm very happy where we are. And so I'd like to just continue what we're doing.
Well, thank you so much, Victor. We wish you all the luck with it and hope to have you back in the podcast and you can report back and tell us what you found.
I would really look forward to doing that. We've got some exciting explorations ahead of us.
Thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll be back with you to catch up on all the latest news from the superyacht world next week.